And we're sitting at the meeting now, officially opened, and welcome everyone who's here. Apologies, the next agenda item for the host of them is about 4-5. Honorable Tinto is still off sick. She was discharged hospital on Saturday. But she's recuperating from home, as well as Honorable Khadebe. I understand now he's in Mpumalanga now, recuperating at home. He's not here. And then Sisa Njikelana, he's at the PAP in Joburg, Pan African Parliament. Mapela is attending public accounts hearing on defense, and the DG is attending the select committee. She has never appeared before the select committee. Those are the apologies. Do we accept, reject what? Muta?
Accept.
Any second? Okay, and third by Lucas. Okay. The briefing, first briefing will be from the department about the nuclear and skills in the industry and transformation, and then NEXA followed by NNR. Firstly, I think the house issues. Today is the last meeting before we go on a mini recess. Like next week, I'm sure you know that 26 to 30 is constituency work, so we'll not be here. But when we come back, we're supposed to have a briefing by the department in terms of our programs. On the 4th of May, we're supposed to get the briefing on the Electricity Regulation Amendment Bill, as well as the Independent System and Market Operator Bill. I'm told those two bills are still with the cabinet committees, so we cannot then deal with them as a portfolio committee. They have not yet been referred to us as parliament. In that regard, then it changes a bit on our program. The next work was on the 6-7, which was the oversight visit to the CEF. We'll then have a discussion, I think, after whether we put that forward to Tuesday, starting that Tuesday, have those few days then for oversight work, and then we'll deal with the program as we come back, updated one. But it's within the framework that we have adopted as a committee. It's just that the two bills are still in cabinet. Is that in order? Any comments from members? Agreed? Okay. All right then, can you hand over to the department? I'm not sure who's in the department from the DDGs who are here. To give us a briefing then, and then we'll go to next analyst.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. My name is Ompia Pane, and I will share the presentation with my colleague, Mr. Debuko Khomo. What we intend to do is to give a very brief overview from a skills perspective in the nuclear sector, internally to the department and within the various SOEs generally, and then we will then hand over to NEXA and NNR to make some inputs. So, Chair, with your permission, we'll go straight into the presentation. Maybe at the onset to indicate that skills in the nuclear sector is an extremely serious challenge, so we're not even contesting the matter of transformation and so on. I think the legacy around the nuclear program in this country is well documented. What we will indicate here is how we have then moved on to try and redress that. And one of the ways we're doing that is through the training and skills development aspect. So I will hand over to Dita Boko, who will go into the detail, and then I will come back to conclude.
Thanks, Mr.
Pani.
Thanks, Chairperson. I'll just go right into the presentation. The current status of skills in the sector are as outlined on the slide. In the department, we currently have a structure where the core nuclear staff is about 12 people. In the new structure in the Department of Energy, we will grow to about 60 employees. NEXA employs about 1,900 people. The ESCOM nuclear cluster is about 1,800 employees, and the NNR is about 92, and the PBMR is 850 people, but we know that they are currently undergoing restructuring and looking to retrench about 75% of the employees. Last year, we went through an exercise where we did a skills demand analysis, and there were four scenarios that we looked at. The scenario one was assuming that the program will remain as it is. We'll just have the Safari 1 reactor at NEXA and the program there, and the Kuberg nuclear power station. Now, what that scenario showed is that to maintain the current program, we need to be training about 50 postgraduate students in all the fields, engineering, science, and have about 150 professionals joining the workforce. And in the second scenario, it was all the projects that the different companies, NEXA, NNR, ESCOM, Itemba Labs, and the different government departments that need to govern the sector. So that scenario showed that between 2010 and 2030, we would need to have about 100 postgraduate students every year coming onto the stream, and about, on average, 200 professionals joining the sector. Scenario three was including us building one nuclear power station, and that power station would come online in about 2018. Now, that scenario showed that we need to still produce about 100 postgraduate students and have between 200 and 400 professionals joining the sector anywhere between 2010 and peaking at 2022. In scenario four, we assumed a fleet approach where, as a country, we will build on average two nuclear power stations every year, starting from, at the time we looked at, starting from 2010, where the build program will start in 2010. So that said, that still on average we need to produce about 100 postgraduate students every year, and between 200 and, again, picking at 400 professionals joining the profession, and then that will decrease starting from 2024, where you only need on average 250 professionals trained in the sector. So all the numbers are addressing, you know, new employees coming onto the stream, replacing, you know, people who retire or people who leave the sector. So we're looking at all those numbers. Now, once we finished that demand side analysis work, what we now need to do is to check if the supply side, the universities and the education system and the further training institutions can actually meet that demand. That is work that will be undertaken during this year. Now, the initiatives that are currently happening in the department is that we have a small external bursary program which started in 2008. It is funded to about 300,000 per annum. We also have an internship program where each directorate is required to have a minimum of two interns. What we find is that generally these are actually postgraduate students that have gone through the programs at the University of the Northwest, most of them, and others from other universities as well. Then we have a contract energy officer program where in 2008 we got approval to have about 10 contract energy officer posts, where usually what happens is that we get to absorb the people who were then on the internship program into those three-year contract posts. The initiatives in the industry that all the different companies have programs that they will tell you about today. the external and internal bursary programs, the internships, the learnership, and the leadership development programs for the employees. Then at NEXA, we have a nuclear skills development center that was established last year, and it is currently operational. And at NEXA, we are now looking to establish the National Nuclear Security Center that will ensure proper training of physical protection personnel for nuclear installations. And then we have what is called the South African Nuclear Human Asset and Research Program. This program is housed at the DST, and its initial focus was the PBMR project. It is funded to the tune of 1.15 billion rand over 10 years. So every year the program gets about 15 million rand. And they focus... $150 million over 10 years. Per annum, they get 15 million.
What?
Okay, he will clarify the numbers when he wraps up. The program sponsors students from high school in grade 10 all the way to postgraduate level, and it also establishes research chairs. We have one chair at the University of Pretoria, the carbon chair, and we also have the nuclear engineering chair at the University of the Northwest. I know that we are now looking to establish the radioactive waste management research chair, and that process is undertaken within the framework of the research chairs program of the DST. Then we have the artisan training, where the sector has partnered with the South African Institute of Welders. On this particular one, in fact, we also do get requests from the International Atomic Energy Agency to train people from other countries. Then we as a country continue to use the opportunities that are provided by the International Atomic Energy Agency, where there are training opportunities ranging from fellowships to 1 week workshops and training workshops. Then at NEXA, we have what is called AREXA, which is a joint venture established between Areva and NEXA, and that program is used to access funding for skills development. And those, Chairperson, are the initiatives that we currently have to address the issues of skills in the nuclear sector. I'll hand over to Mr. Pana.
Without much further ado, I think it is very clear that there are initiatives in terms of which certain skills are being acquired. There is a plan, as you can see, to try and at least get to an understanding as to where the shortfalls are. There's just some clarity regarding the numbers. Firstly, it's not a cumulative approach in the graphs. It indicates the annual numbers that will be required. So when you say 400, it does not mean that in that year it's 400 people. It's 400 new people, right? So ultimately, you have to add all of those numbers up. And then secondly, 1.15 billion over 10 years is 115 million a year, not 15 million. If I can just leave it at that, Chair. It's
1.15 billion. Then it will be
100 million. Yeah, sure, it's a mistake with the billion.
The billion is the
mistake. That's a good mistake. Hey, what is it?
Okay. It's quite a shock to the department. Do you want to engage with it, or we allow for NNR first and then next afterwards? To have a discussion at once, extra agenda, or
No, no.
You are fine, you're okay.
The agenda is okay, Chairperson.
Hmm?
The agenda is okay.
Madam Chair, we appreciate the privilege, but could we ask for deference to the operator and come after them, please?
Why?
There are regulatory issues that we need to attend to while the operator is in operation. Please, if it pleases the House.
Our presentation is relatively high level. We made the decision that we were not going to go into all of the tables that exist in the annual report and in the employment equity plan. We would certainly make those available to the committee should that be desirable. But what we've done is we've surfaced some issues that the sector in general and NEXA in particular face in the area of human resource development, skills provision, transformation, etc., in the hope that will stimulate some discussion. And, of course, my team is on hand to provide the figures about NEXA should the need arise to provide those figures. I want to, at this stage, Chair, hand over to Dan Wahi, who is our Group Executive for Human Resources. Dan?
Chair, I'm always accused that my voice is soft. I hope everyone can hear me. Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Members. This presentation actually is complementary to the presentation that Debo just made. So some of the information, I'm not going to go into details because Debo have already touched on that. This is a table of contents. I'm not going to go through the slides. Firstly, we start with the nuclear policy framework, and we only extrapolated three bullet points which are relevant for this presentation. The first bullet point about diversification of energy source and nuclear as part of that. The second part is the contribution that, or the acknowledgement of the contribution that nuclear energy would play in the economic growth and technology development in the country. And the third bullet point is about the institutional arrangement and the importance of developing human resource development around this area. I think the key strategic issue that one has to consider basically is that our the workforce is aging, and as a result, there's insufficient knowledge transfer to younger generation. I think when we look at transformation, we have to look at transformation broadly. We can't talk of transformation in this sector only from a race and gender perspective, but age plays a critical role here, and it takes time to develop that pipeline. So you can't talk of transformation basically in the line of you know, within the context of race and gender, age is very critical. It's something that needs to be taken into account during the planning process. The demand for nuclear skill is limited to specific skill sets, and the skill development feeder system and process are not attracting enough young skilled and professional people to sustain the growth in the area. As I'm saying, age is one of those things that you have to take into account, because I think to build a competent skills in this area takes time. One of the worrying factors is the downsizing of PBMR, which is, you know, is contracting the sector and creates a negative vibe or energy among, or enthusiasm among the young people who want to take careers in this area, because it creates panic that there's no future in the industry. So it's something that cannot be ignored at all. Lack of investment in big projects, and in the absence of the new nuclear plants, very few young people seek themselves having careers in nuclear area, and it's something that we cannot take for granted. And the decision to for the nuclear build program is very key in terms of generating interest and enthusiasm in this area. According to TAPRO, 80,000 people are required acquire skills as artisan or in related areas, and this number is huge. I think they will touch on the need for artisan in his presentation, in her presentation. Key factors that need to be taken into account: the life cycle of the nuclear industry is characterized by long-term horizons, technical complexities, and compromised quality. Therefore, you cannot just fast-track young people in this area. You need to have proper planning to make sure that by the time they are qualified, nuclear scientists or nuclear engineer or artisans, whatever, they have received proper and quality training, which means that we have to start early in terms of developing the skill base. We don't have to wait for the decisions to be announced and then later you start building skills. You need to start, you prepare for peace, you prepare for war during a period of peace. So it's one of the issues that needs to be taken into account. Earlier, nuclear power plants were designed to operate for 30 to 40 years. Today, the lifespan is 50 to 60 years. Nuclear activities from cradle to cave may be in excess of 100 years when one considers the issue of nuclear waste and decommissioning processes. Challenges in retaining the nuclear skill. Key question that needs to be asked is how to retain existing skills and competencies for a long period during which a plant is operating, especially when facilities in that country may be at the end of the life cycle. I think South Africa is, at the moment, is a case in point with Nexa and Kuber. How do we develop and retain new skills and competencies in university commissioning and radioactive waste, which are not attractive to young guys, young generation? And how do we revive nuclear power in countries which need to do so with aging workforce? How do we strike a balance between how do we tap in the experience of the aging workforce by bringing in young generation in the absence of big projects? It's a bit difficult to do that, and I have to find creative ways of addressing that. The key stakeholders in the nuclear industries, they are well known. I'm not going to repeat that slide. This is the current skills available in the sector. it's worrying that if you look at number of scientists, the percentage of scientists that we have in the sector, we're sitting at 8. It's worrisome, basically. It's something that needs to be taken into account. I think my next slide will indicate why this is important. If you look at this slide, I think this is the ranking of critical skills in the sector. Engineer with nuclear certification is the first one. If you look at scientists, they are sitting at 2.6, and we don't have enough of them. And I think it's something that needs to be, you know, taken into cognizance. Demand for nuclear skills. This slide, they will hold. Touch on that. I'm not going to present that. The HRD interventions, it was also mentioned in the DOE presentation. These are the instruments that have been put in place, that we are actively participating in making sure that we develop these skills. Yes. SANAP, I'm not going to repeat that. NIASA is an instrument where all nuclear stakeholders participate.
Through you, Chair, could I ask that those acronyms be spelled out for some of us? NIASA, for instance, I don't know what it is.
And this is a very important initiative. It's a one of our subsidiaries. Nexa is 51% equity. And 49% is Arriva. The joint initiative basically to develop skills in this area. And I think it's critical that you don't only also have other key instruments with other players, international players in this area, like Westinghouse and Hitachi and others. But this indicates how we can collaborate with key international players to transfer skills in this regard. Next, the Bursary Program. This is a very successful initiative. When it started, it was only funding postgraduates, masters and PhDs. This year, we took over students who had contracts with PBMR, so we are funding both undergraduate and PBMR in collaboration with DST in this regard, and SANAP, DST, NRF, NEXA internship. This process, I think, has been going on for 4 or 5 years. It's one of those initiatives that Rob started at DST. Currently, we are having, I think, 20 students. They requested, these are graduates, basically, who are in training. They're being paid stipends on a monthly basis, but they're really working. We requested 30, but we could only get 20 because of the number of students that have applied, or graduates that have applied. So this one is dependent on the demand side. DST is funding the whole initiative, but we place students in our own facilities. But strictly, it's not, we are not taking, we are taking students with masters and PhDs in this area, in core areas. We are not taking students in support functions, in core areas of our business. Next, our mentorship coaching program. I've mentioned that we have to close a gap between the aging workforce and the young generation. And initiatives that have been taken at NEXA was to develop a Madala program where the nuclear experts who have retired, to bring them back in the system to mentor young generation as part of skills transfer. The new Cities Development Center is doing very well. Colleagues visited, honorable members visited the center. What we are busy with now, we just got accreditation from CETA to establish the trade test center to complement this. And we are busy with that process because I think the national waiting list for artisan or apprentice to qualify as artisan take longer. Olifantsfontein Trade Test Center, the queue there is very long. So we are in that process, and we hope that by the first quarter of this year, we'll be having our own trade test center. We are also collaborating with the department to make sure that we establish their security training as part of this. And there's an initiative to mobilize funding to make sure that project kick off. The DST NRF Research Share Program, this is mainly in the research area, is fully funded by the NRF, and the joint collaboration between DST, NRF, and relevant universities in this area. MAS program is a master's program that is ongoing with the University of Northwest. And in terms of trying to salvage some of the top skills that we have at PBMR, we are planning to absorb top scientists and engineers from them to join us. Challenge here will be resources. We are busy with that process. We haven't finalized it yet. Yes.
Remember that the two NEXA beneficiaries of the NEXA bursary program sitting in the room right now. One is here, and the other one is Machina Diagram over there. So these are object lessons for the success of the NEXA bursary program.
And they're both young black women. recommendations. We recommend, I think it's very critical that collaboration at all levels with all stakeholders take place, both nationally and internationally, something that you cannot run away from. I think it's also critical to invest in large or high-profile R&D programs. In the absence of this, there's no future of nuclear in this country. So it's something that we need to take very seriously. And I've also mentioned in the last slide that we have to absorb top priority PBMR staff, both scientists and engineers. This is a national security issue. If we lose some of these top guys to other countries, it's really a problem. We really need to do something about this. It's not only about saving skills, but intellectual property, own intelligence. I think it's very critical that we do this. Our budget is not really good. The grants that we get from government actually is consumed by salaries. But this is a priority that we need to make sure that we address. And we plan to make a submission during the adjustment of estimates because this is unforeseen as it's critical to make sure that we convince Treasury to give us something. And the problem with this thing is salaries are recurring expenditure. They are not once-off things. So I think we will work with the department to make sure that we retain these skills within South Africa. This, I think, is a national issue. And also have attractive salary packages. Currently, we don't lose a lot of staff because of the recession. But as soon as there's an economic boom, we'll lose staff to other areas. So I think it's important that we don't only use good packages, but we also have good programs, exciting programs for young guys who will want to develop their careers in the industry. On that basis, through you, Chair, thanks very much. This is the end of the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Mahi. We'll then move to NNR. I'm sure NNR is ready now. you can conclude and then deliberate. Over to you.
I'm not sure.
They're waiting for questions.
I was thinking about from
Nexa, yeah. No, they are waiting for questions. Don't worry. They are waiting for questions. They are okay. I can see them.
Indulgence, Madam Chair, whilst we exchange for technology.
Okay, while they're trying to deal with the technology, I forgot one issue, that is the housekeeping one. There's a letter that I've received from METI Training Institute, I'm sure, to deal with the mineral energy training. They wrote a letter to say that it is tradition for the chairperson to sit on the board. The other chairs, my predecessors, I understand, were part of the MITI training. So I said I'll hear from the committee members whether they endorse that or feel otherwise. It is not standard that because the other chairs were, we still have to bring the issue back to the committee as the fourth parliament. What is your view on that?
Just to say, Chair, if you can bear the load, I would recommend it. I've had associations with them. So.
Okay, no, fine. That is okay.
How long are you going to keep? Minute or two? Okay. So we've got the technology being.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're ready. Thank you, Honourable Members of the Controller Committee, and also thank you for the invite. In terms of what we intend to cover also, it's more or less overlapping with the two presentations that have gone before us. But essentially, we'll cover the issues around the staff complement, the technical division. In terms of the demographic profile, that will cover race, gender, disability, but also we've added another component, which is the age analysis, issue, which we believe is quite critical in the consideration of skills within the nuclear industry or nuclear sector, particularly when that is viewed against the issue of succession and issue of critical shortages within the industry. And we also just highlight a few critical positions and the issue of the skills pipeline supply. Just in terms of the, I'm sorry that this table is a bit too small. You might need a magnifying glass to get through to it, but I'll just try and run quickly the most essential areas. This is just the general staff complement of the NNR. You will see that in terms of senior managers, we've got 85% black, 28% female. You've got, and of course, then it follows the 15%, which is the remainder. It's basically for white people. Managers at 70% black, 30% female. At the level of professional specialists, coordinators, senior specialists, etc., you're sitting at 69% black, vis-a-vis a percentage of 29% for females. And of course, the contrasting percentage of the balance would go to the white people. And at administration level, we've got 63% black, 72% of females in that category. And the grand total is 68% black. That is basically the organizational statistic, and 39% female. Of course, a far cry from the 50-50 representation that we would like to see as part of the initiatives that we have seen at a national level. That's generally at the broad staff complement level. In terms of the technical division itself, there's this busy slide, but it just gives an indication of the demographic profile breakdown of the individuals within the technical division, which I think is the critical division that we mostly concerned about in terms of nuclear skills in this context. Things of note there in terms of that particular diagram or graph is that there are no Africans in the Quebec program or department. The implication, of course, of this is that Africans have minimal opportunity to actually no opportunity to acquire the power reactor technology competencies at the NNR, which is a very critical and core skill. If we are to develop going forward in terms of nuclear technology, we would obviously need proficiencies within that area. And if there are no African people that are exposed to that particular type of technologies, it basically inhibits the pace at which we can develop as the regulator in meeting the demands of the nuclear progression or nuclear development program. And of course, this brings to bear the issue of whether or not we have adequate capacity to be able to deal with these issues. What complicates the matter even further, as you'll see later on, is the fact that the leadership of the Quebec program in itself is the leadership that is basically going towards the age of retirement, and therefore it does pose serious challenges in terms of what sort of succession planning is in place to meet the kind of demands that are presented by this challenge. 83% of the RENS department, which is the regulation of natural resources, that's mainly the department that deals with the mines and the facilities in the mines, looking at radiation issues there. 83% of that department is African, followed by nuclear technology and waste project. 42% of the assessment group is a group that basically looks into the applications for licensure and related issues. Would consist of the sum total of engineering and configuration management, facility conditioning management, and radiation protection and emergency planning staff. And the 42% of that particular facility is white, compared to 38%, which is African. And of course, that's another area which is of critical importance, because you want to ensure that there is an appropriate mix there in terms of skill, but also in terms of demographic profile, to be able to get steeped into the traditions of nuclear technology analysis and understanding of what is it that is required from a point of view of regulation. And so the percentages are quite low at that level. This is a slide that just shows the female population of the technical division specifically, which is far from being sufficiently representative. It is currently sitting at 39%. And even in terms of the 39%, most of the female colleagues are actually at positions or levels that are not necessarily at of sufficient seniority within the organization. And therefore, there is a shortage in that particular area. In terms of age distribution, that's very busy slide as well. Just gives you a reflection of what the age distribution is, starting from the under 30s to your plus 60. And it gives you just a reflection of what the age analysis and profile of the NNR is, but also it gives you an indication per department what sort of age issues we're looking at. 22% of the staff in technical positions is above age 50. Now, that should actually create some anxiety on any one of us, given the fact that you're looking at just about 10 years before people actually take retirement. And therefore, if you've got 22% of the staff in the technical positions that are above the age of 50, it already calls into question what sort of developmental programs you have in place, what sort of succession planning you have in place to ensure that you meet those gaps as and when they arise. And these positions would include 3 senior regulatory officers, 2 principal specialists, 3 senior specialists, 2 process coordinators, senior legal advisor, senior manager, and manager at the Quebec program. And these are individuals that have gone beyond the age 50, and of course who would be most likely leaving the organization. This is just a reflection of the critical positions within the NNR, particularly from the technical side, and I won't necessarily go through all of them, but just the positions that relate to functional subgroup coordinators in the assessment group division, the power reactor division, the senior manager, which I've alluded to, the manager Quebec program, the issues around the PBMR and capability with regards to that, and of course we know the developments that have come about in relation to those issues. And so those are critical positions. What about the supply? In terms of these critical positions, the supply has not been as adequate as we would have loved it to be. But there are certain interventions, and I'll talk to these in a little while, that we have initiated as an organization to look into the issue of skills development. Part of that process is was the establishment of the Talent Management Forum. And part of the outcomes of that particular forum have been to identify about 20 potential successors who basically are ring-fenced or put aside in a succession pool of some sort, and they basically have to be put through into some kind of an accelerated training program in order to equip them with the necessary skill and competencies to meet the requirements of the positions that ought to be filled. Of the 20 that have been identified as potential successors, 11 in the technical division will be ready within the first 2 years. And they have been identified for manager and functional subgroup coordinator positions. 2 of the 5 technical graduates in training have been deployed within the NNR in the last 2.5 years. And we've got new graduates in training, which also have been recruited for the 2010-2011 financial year.
What is the summary analysis? We have an appropriate blend of color organizationally, but lack color in critical nuclear areas. I think that's the overall summation of my presentation. Where you need the critical mass in terms of supply of the skills in the areas that matter in terms of nuclear industry and nuclear technology understanding and appreciation, you actually have some kind of a deficit in terms of the people of color filling those particular positions. And it is an issue that might appear distorted by our statistics, because while organizationally we're looking fine and healthy in terms of the demographic profile, when it comes to the area that matters most, which is the nuclear appreciation, the nuclear skills, we're actually deficient when it comes to those areas in terms of having those individuals at those levels. So that's the overall summation of the NNR picture with regards to what is happening at the level of nuclear skills. Some of the initiatives, which I've already alluded to some degree, Challenge Management Forum, which I've spoken to just in a little while, it's a program really aimed at identifying critical skills within the organization and talent to match the required skills, and also to look at the accelerated growth and development programs for those individuals in order to ensure that they are equipped to fit the bill in those particular positions. We have also some kind of a modest bursary program, approximately 500,000 per annum, and I'm certain that members would appreciate that is a far cry from, when you look at the issues of adequacy and the kind of costs that go with training and developing nuclear scientists. But that's the bursary we have because of the reality of the allocation we have from Treasury. We also participate in AREXA, and that's been that has been alluded to in the presentation by AREXA and then DOE. We also have some kind of IAEA exchange programs and international exchange programs where we take some of our people to be exposed to what is happening at the IAEA level or also in other regulators. We're in the process through our minister to try and formalize a much more rigorous program that could ensure that we identify and develop skills in the most critical areas. We also have an organization which is called the South African Young Nuclear Science Professionals, and its aim, amongst others, is to really harness the skills from the young South Africans and ensure that those particular young people are channeled appropriately and they develop into fully mature nuclear scientists and that they can be deployed appropriately in the industry. Incidentally, it's been given an honor to host the international conference, which is coming up, I think, in July this year, here in Cape Town. And I think it will be a great opportunity for members of the committee to also attend some of the sessions and be exposed to the issues that confront young nuclear scientists, you know, worldwide, and also how that, you know, interacts with our own issues and our own experiences in our context in South Africa. And we also have an organization which is called Women in Nuclear. It's also about raising the profile and putting onto the fore the issues around women empowerment, particularly in terms of the nuclear in the nuclear area. And there are a few programs that are run. Of course, the resources are always an issue when it comes to this, but part of it has been the issue of looking at the school's outreach program to try and attract young students into the nuclear field in terms of their careers and development. The future, the future holds a lot of uncertainties in terms of the future direction of the country and decisions in particular around what's going to become of nuclear technology and development. But we do know that there are certain policy decisions that have been taken which are quite evident in the energy policy, which advocate for an energy mix portfolio within the country, which in itself includes, amongst others, the issue of nuclear technology. And therefore, if that is part of the mix of the portfolio, we therefore need to prepare ourselves for the eventuality, and the DOE has alluded to certain scenarios which include the issue of what if one nuclear power station is built, what sort of requirements we would need. That goes for what the NNR would also require in order to assess the issues of feasibility, in terms of safety and security, and all of the issues relating to nuclear security that have come to the fore. And so we need to explore the skills development pipeline, going back to the schooling system, because I think sometimes we tend to come in at the tail end when we're not receiving the kind of product that we're supposed to receive, and that's where we get concerned. I think we should be focusing on the production line right from the feeder system, the schooling system. Do we have sufficient profile of the nuclear science as a field, as a subject? Are there systems in place to support science development? To what extent do we interact with other role players, the Department of Science and Technology, Department of Education, Department of Higher Education, of Basic Education and Higher Education, and to what extent we collaborate and interact with those particular role players to ensure that we've got a seamless development program, I think is going to determine the level of our success going forward. And of course, one of the areas we would need to look into, it's not been major per se, but I think it is an issue that has got a potential of developing and escaping us, and it's an area around nuclear facility interpoaching, the issue of people moving within the same industry, within the same sector. It's a small industry that we're running in the country. We probably would need to apply ourselves to the standardization of remuneration systems within the industry. And it's a very radical thought to put forward, but I think it is important if we are to stabilize the processes around the issue of skills in the industry. It's an issue we cannot ignore. People will move for better opportunities within the same industry if they have a potential of offering something better and something more. And so we'd have to confront that reality going forward. And of course, I think finally, we might need to look at management processes for succession planning and also exploit bilateral agreements that we have with other developed countries that have got mature nuclear technology systems and where we can benefit in terms of exposure and experience, etc. And these are some of the thoughts that we thought we could just throw into this discussion and debate. And I would wish to thank you, Madam Chair, and Honourable Portfolio Committee members. Thank you.
Thank you, Elena. But we don't have a copy of the presentation. I'm not sure whether other members have. We don't have. If we can facilitate that we have the copies, it will work better.
Thanks.
Members will take a note.
Sorry, Madam, we'll facilitate that.
Okay. All right. We've had all the three presentations, members. Now is the time for deliberations, questions. Honorable Lucas, don't look so despondent. What has gone wrong? I mean, just as if your terrible tsunami or volcano is still in Europe, is not yet in South Africa.
I think I'm going to try and express it. Just
okay. Lucas, Mutau, Silam. Those are the first three.
Thanks, Chairperson. I didn't know it was so noticeable. First of all, let me begin with the aging issue is very important, and one realizes that there should be some sort of system where when older people go out, the younger people come in. However, many years ago, when I thought 40 was old, and now I think 70 is young. So aging is relative. So we need to look at it very seriously. And then sometimes we get rid of all the experience that is obtained. We should find a system where we can transfer that sort of knowledge. But what's worried me is this PBMR. I'm not sure whether I'm hearing right or I'm reading it too much into it of what hasn't been said. Because we've spent a great deal of money in the PBMR. We've gone a long, long way. Now, I see that we're talking, the absorption of top scientists from PBMR. And then I see another one, absorb top the priority skills from PBMR. Is there going to be a shutdown? Because if there is going to be, it's going to be a sad day for our country. You spend so much money developing it, making it popular, and then at the end of the day you stop. And what is sure going to happen? Some other country will adopt this baby, develop this baby, and sell it back to us at a high price, as though we give. And as it's been all our effort and the hard work of our people in South Africa. And that is what is really depressing.
Thank you, Chair. I think Honorable Lucas has made the case very well for PBMR, so I'll move on to the other point. In terms of the skills development, in terms of young people and stuff, I think enough has been said. Can you just flesh out for us how the bursary scheme is doing, how the mentorship scheme is doing in terms of real people, real numbers, so that we get a feel of whether we're making progress or not as we try to keep and retain the skills? And then I want to take you back to the next presentation at the end. Recommendations. And I think the case has been well made. The problem has been stated. The question from me to you is, what are you doing about these things that you say need to happen? Have you got a plan? Are you going to be presenting a plan to this committee and say, guys, we have this plan. We want all to whoever. We have this plan. We think this is what can be done to be able to retain these skills, to be able to fast-track the kinds of skills that we need. Because we can't help you with that. We depend on you guys to tell us what you're going to be doing so that we can say whether it makes sense or doesn't make sense and assist where we can assist. Because as Honorable Lucas has said, you know, when you talk about absorb, where are you going to absorb them? What do you mean absorb? To what? Into what? So if you can give me some sense of what's happening there, I might be able to get a handle. Thanks.
Chairperson, linked to the very absorption Honorable Mutau is making reference to, on the needs analysis in the first presentation, there are a number of scenarios, the 2, 3, and 4. I wouldn't worry much about scenario 1 because it doesn't seem to have problems with the issue I'm trying to raise. Between 2010 and 2022, this suggests that a lot of people will be absorbed under scenario 2. Scenario 3 would go along the same line, and scenario 4 would go into 2026. You would have the peak, the highest volume of people there. But if you take the professionals, all right, let's concentrate on the total and not the professionals. And at the end of it, by 2030, it has gone down again, which means you by then, 2030, you will have more people than you needed earlier. Because, say, by 2022, in scenario 2, You can see your graph there. It's at about 630, 640, and by 2030, you would only be needing, say, about 410, 420, somewhere like that. Then those other people, what in terms of this scenario will happen to them? And I'm asking this question, of course, also informed by the presentations that came after you. Almost in all your presentations, including yours, you're talking about the scarcity of the nuclear skill and how much we must be able to keep these people by way of decent salaries or attractive salaries. But this scenario says at some point you are going to want to retrench people. And I'm also linking this to the issue of the closure of PBMR. If PBMR is getting closed or reduced, and there are skills there, are we not talking in backwards and forwards to say we will produce more skills and thereafter not need them? On the one hand, we are just about to cut down staff because we are now reducing the need in PBMR on this one hand. On the other hand, we need to absorb a lot of people that we can train and throw away.
Thank you, Chair. On page 5 of the key strategic issues, the industry needs to invest in big projects. And I've just read in the newspaper this morning in the Burger, Afrikaans newspaper, that it takes 10 years to build a nuclear plant. And we clearly see that we have to attract young professionals and sustain knowledge transfer from aging workforce to young professionals. So it takes a bit of time so that they can visibly see, look, I would like to be a nuclear scientist. And takes such a long time to build these projects, so it's not so visible and it's not so easy to encourage them to become nuclear professionals. But what I gathered in the clipping that I read in the Afrikaans newspaper, and this was about the National Union of Mine Workers, that the ministers were present there, Ministers Hogan and Peters. And it seems that there was a huge concern that we don't see enough momentum in terms of perhaps big projects for nuclear. And I would just like to ask the question today, perhaps, and it's perhaps out of ignorance, what seems to be the big delay? Is there anything we as politicians can do? What is expected of us if we can have some guidance? And perhaps I'm linking myself to the Honourable Mata, where he specifically spoke about the, and this is about skills development, but I would like to know what can we as politicians, what is expected from us? Perhaps because we have the knowledgeable people here today, what is expected of us to see that we indeed give enough momentum, that we see that there's huge projects in terms of nuclear, and at least define and have a strategic intent regarding nuclear. Because if I analyze the newspaper clipping, it ends sort of in, yes, something needs to be done, but we still have to talk about it. And perhaps that's what we should end. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is on the PBMR as well, because here it said 850 people are employed and currently restructuring, and therefore there's going to be, if I'm not mistaken, it was 75% to be retrenched or so. And in the other presentation, it also says absorb top priority skills from PBMR by motivating for budget increase during this adjustment estimate. I'm not clear about these two statements. And I would like to ask again about the grade 10 students
who will be taken into the scientist side, how are you going to do it? Are you only going to look at Gauteng as you are based in Gauteng, or are you going to accommodate all provinces? And how are you going to call for those students to be trained in this sector? Thank you, Chair.
Okay, maybe just as the last one from myself. What I don't get clear is that starting from the department, this few pages that have been prepared, to me it's like New Tier is one of those things, not one of the core. So am I right or wrong, or that is the truth, or what? Because if you talk about the energy mix policy, but on other programs, it's more allocation, and to this one in particular, you must have a reason why, as a department, you are taking that line. Is it not a priority for nuclear for this financial year and the coming year, or what? Secondly, last year, during the annual report, you told us between NNR and NEXA, there's poaching there that's happening. But it was at the time, if I'm still, if my memory is still okay, NNR was suffering from NEXA. NEXA was poaching more from the NNR stuff, because NNR's budget doesn't allow them then to pay, not competitive, whatever NEXA is paying. And that created a bit of a problem at the time last year. Is it still a problem even now, or that has changed? And from the department, I'm not sure then if the regulator is less funded than the operator. What does that mean? Is it not creating a bit of a problem, or what? But the Madala program, how far is it assisting in terms of transformation process? Is it just the tip of an iceberg, or is it coming okay, or whatever? But if I listen to Mr. Moahi very well, the long and short of this, and also from NNF, is that we have employment equity operating in South Africa, but not in the nuclear. There's no employment equity there. It doesn't work due to the scarce skills or whatever. But it seems then you are immune then from the laws of the country due to the scarcity of the skills. Why? And yeah. If we can get the responses then.
Thanks, Chairperson. The issue of the PBMR, I must say that it is being handled by the Minister of Public Enterprises, because the PBMR reports there, but we are part of the interministerial committee that has been convened to look at the issues of the PBMR. So it's a little bit of a difficult one for me to actually answer to the details of the, you know, the announcements that have come out of there, that in the retrenchment of the 75% of employees, because that was the information that was communicated by the PBMR as a company. What informs those numbers is not actually clear to us. I would ask Rob that once I've gone through all the questions, that he gives a view that might be a little bit more informative, as because he is a member of the board of the PBM. On how the bursary scheme is doing and the mentorship, in the department, as I said, the bursary scheme is very small. It is funded to a tune of about 200,000 per annum. So we have about 6 students. 2 will be finishing this year. 1 is finishing his master's, and 1 is finishing his mechanical engineering degree, and then we have the other four that are in different levels. You know, two are starting this year in first year, and the other two are either in second or third year. It's a very small program, and it is funded from our current allocations. In terms of the numbers on the demand analysis scenarios, the numbers are not cumulative. And what happens is that we're dealing with all the skills that you will need at the different stages of the program. So this goes from you know, the skills from the planning, the construction, the operations, the maintenance, and the decommissioning, and you know, waste issues right at the end. So it's the whole spectrum of the skills that you would need at the different stages of the program. So obviously, during the commissioning stages and operations, you need, you know, different numbers of employees and different sets of those skills than when you're doing construction or when you're actually doing decommissioning. So there's different skill sets that are required at different stages of the nuclear program.
So if I may just explain that one, the reference to retrenchment is actually incorrect. That graph indicates the number of new skills required on an annual basis. It's not a cumulative indication of the total people required. So how you read it is that beyond 2020, we will not require as many new, but it does not say the ones that we are already in the system will be required. Will be retrenched. It just says that we don't need as many new entrants, but if you accumulate that, all those people that are in those jobs will remain in their jobs. It's not like they will be retrenched.
There was the issue of the number of years it takes to build a nuclear power plant. I must say that the 10 years, because members will hear from you know, the people who build nuclear power stations, they'll tell you that it takes 4.5 or 5 years to build, and then you would have had the 10 years to build a nuclear power plant. The 10 years is the period from the time you make a decision that you will build, because when you make that decision, it's not as if everything will be ready tomorrow and you start construction. So from the time a decision is taken that we will build a nuclear power plant to you know, the contract negotiations, which take a long time, to the construction, the commissioning, and now when the power plant itself actually operates. So the 10 years includes the time you need to make all those decisions. And what the delay is regarding the decisions about the nuclear, this issue is being dealt with through the Interministerial Committee on Energy, and it is also, you know, going to be part. It's also part of the work on the IRP. So I don't want to characterize it as delays, but maybe Mr. Pani can help me there.
If I may check through you, the question about nuclear not being a priority and why we don't have this big program is that we are in the middle of a process to conclude the integrated resource plan, because that is how you define how much nuclear will be required in the mix. And without preempting the outcome of that consultative process, you know, you can't then build and then go and consult people about what to build. So after June this year, we will have a sense as to what the base load requirement is, and also as to what the different technologies are that will be used to meet that demand. And at that point, you will then start seeing the decision taking a lot more momentum. So it certainly is not a reflection on the prioritization of the UK program at all. I don't know if there's any inference that it's not taken seriously. As I indicated, you know, there will be a lot more momentum around it just after the IRP has been indicated. Just to give you some sense, we think that we might have to build a base load power station every 3 years from about 2020. And chances are, if we can't go coal, it's very likely to be UTN. That way, you'll be able to see
a lot more momentum around that.
Sorry, the last point was about the funding of the regulator in relation to the operator. I think it's a worldwide kind of problem that unfortunately the regulators tend to be smaller and less resourced than the actual operators, and unless the salaries in the regulator are increased, what tends to happen is that you don't draw the necessary top-notch, you know, skills into the regulator. This is not peculiar to South Africa. What we, however, need to do in relation to the NNR, PPMR kind of scenario is to manage it. In other words, to make sure that we don't create that sort of, if you like, arbitrage of skills where people can move simply because they've been given a financial signal to move to the other entity expense of the regulator. I think that's something that we can control going forward. Make sure that we don't, you know, pay way too much, or that the salaries are completely out of sync between entities within in the same sector.
There's only one more question left. The one about from Honorable Matiwela, how the selection of the grade 10 is done. On that's actually happening on the SANHUB program. What they do is they select by using the Dinaledi schools. So in fact, you know, the program is spread all over the country. They have students in all the 9 provinces. So it's not concentrated in Gauteng. Thanks, Shepherd.
Chair, thanks for the opportunity and also for the invitation from Dieter Bocho to be a little more explicit on PBMR. One thing we need to understand about the current process being undergone at PBMR is that it's still in the 60-day consultation period laid down by the Labor Relations Act. So that at this stage, PBMR management is in negotiations with Labor and the different unions representing the workforce. So that there's no number which is cast in stone at this point. What comes out at the end of the consultation will be what is final. Just a question, where does the 75% come from? Well, it comes from the minimum number of staff required to deliver on the only project which is currently being financed. In other words, the so-called NGNP project funded by the DOE from the United States. This is a design project which is intended to position the PBMR technology globally for other equity partners. And at this stage, the $10 million coming in from the US DOE, plus whatever is left currently in the kitty, there's no money coming in from Treasury in the current financial year. I think 3 million rand or so is all. So effectively, what the management has done is look at what staff are needed to deliver on that project, because it's the only funded project, over the time that delivery is required. And obviously, the fewer staff you have, the longer you can carry on. So that's really what informs that percentage. Because there's nothing at this point in this financial year coming in from the fiscus. In terms of Nexa absorbing staff from PBMR, I mean, there's certain concerns, in particular the fuel staff. Those fuel staff moved across from Nexa to PBMR under the kind of arbitrage that Mr. Apani described earlier, with somewhat higher salaries at PBMR. If that if the program goes ahead as it's been defined, as it's defined currently, that whole fuel division will disappear. And effectively, the possibility of those highly skilled people contributing towards fuel in an Eskom new build will also vanish. So you're sitting in an awkward situation. You're having, on the one hand, PVMR in trouble, and then you're waiting for an Eskom new build. And in the time gap between the difficulties faced by PVMR and the potential retrenchments that we've heard about, and Eskom starting up, you can find 75% of 850 people disappearing. As we all know, there are big construction projects on the go in the United Arab Emirates, in China, and the best people are getting phone calls. It's happening as we speak. The question asked earlier was what can politicians do? I think that with the, again, I stand to have my contribution added to by the department in particular. The issue with nuclear is the peculiar funding structure, in that over the lifetime of a plant, it's relatively cost effective. But all the money is needed up front. Very expensive capital costs, cheap operating costs. And so the trick is having some way of smoothing that. And there are different ways. I mean, you can, the classic way is debt, obviously. The way that the big nuclear operators do it, for example, EDF in France or the American utilities, is that they pay off their nuclear investments, the nuclear plants, over 20 years. The operating lifetime of a plant is upwards of 40 years, 50, 60. What that means is that after 20 years, you're essentially printing money. And so, because of the cheap operating costs. And so, the money from the older plants finances a new build. The possibility here is obviously that you have, as an equity partner, one of those globally established utilities. But what you face here is that equity is always more expensive than debt. And so you'll have the confident partner coming in because they understand the industry. Now, you can't get debt because the banks won't give it to you because your credit rating is gone, shot to pieces. So, you know, it might be preferable to get debt, but you can't get it. The next choice is equity, but equity is more expensive. And so, I mean, there are those big financial issues, and you're talking about, you know, hundreds of billions, not just 1 or 2 billion. And so I think that's one of the key issues facing us is nuclear. If you're established, it's not so hard because you've got the balance sheet. But with one power plant, namely Kuburg, even if you were to separate off nuclear from Eskom and have it generate, you know, its own separate nuclear balance sheet, at this point you'd still not be in that healthy position. So that's my understanding of why there's a delay and so on. The issue of poaching, you know, I mean, this is a difficult one because, I mean, the only transfer, I don't want to use the word poaching, of high-level skills currently that I can remember is somebody Nexa gladly gave up to the regulator who became the chief technology officer. I think the why I say gladly is because I think there's a healthy transfer of skills that's necessary. If you pin people down and you say that you can't move because you've been poached, then the next thing you'll hear is they're working for Westinghouse or Areva or the Chinese or something, because you can't do that to people. I think the issue that the department has said is that it needs to be managed. You can't have huge arbitrages. But on the other hand, I think in the case of the regulator, the way that you manage it is by pushing up the licensing fees. If there are runaway salaries in the operators, then runaway licensing fees in the regulator will counteract that fairly effectively. So, you know, there's a way of doing it rather than defining posts and saying, well, that post's a 500,000 rand post and the other one's a 250. If you do that, you lose everybody because the rest of the world doesn't work like that.
Rob, on that point, is it not maybe possible that we can try to manage it, that people not leaving our country, that although they want to leave a particular sector, but to stay in South Africa?
I think the Nuclear Energy Act has a number of provisions around the transfer of IP, restraint of trade provisions, etc. We just need to work out how to apply it in a labor relations context. You know, but one also has to understand, and this is also in response to the issue of training engineers and then losing them. Engineering is a boom and bust profession. You know, when the pendulum swings globally, when there are big infrastructure bills, then lots of engineers are required. At the end of that swing of the pendulum, engineers are laid off. Our experience, though, with looking at what happened to the large numbers of people laid off by Atomic Energy Corporation in the mid-1990s as a result of the discontinuance of the old strategic programs, was that those people, by and large, did quite well. You know, it's a kind of a paradox where it's hard for somebody to pass, for example, from IT to a nuclear environment or from a chemical sector to a nuclear environment because of the highly regulated and safety-orientated and exact nature of nuclear skills. But it's not that hard for a nuclear person to move to those sectors. So you've got sort of a paradox there where you know, if you train as a nuclear person, you actually can move around. But if you train just in any other area, technical area, it's not so easy for you to penetrate nuclear. So that's I think, the difference. Thank you, Chair. I'll come back if this. And then, Itabatsi, Nashina, Chantal, come in if you want.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think there was a question by the Honorable Mutau about what are we doing with regard to the recommendations and the actual numbers to support that. I will ask in two parts. I think in the presentation, there was a slide, I think slide 13 around the initiatives that we are implementing. We are rolling out this initiative. So part of the things that are in the recommendation is to intensify that. The sky is the limit. Some of these instruments are working well, but we can always improve them. And I think the second part to it, in terms of real numbers, I think we can provide that. We have to communicate this. Responsible for this, most of this initiative, we can compile the stats and share them with the committee. But the information is there, just that I don't have it now. So the question about not having the employment equity or not adhering to Employment Equity Act. Maybe we are part of South Africa. Ntibati there is our response. One of her portfolios is employment equity. I think what we're referring to is that it's difficult to attract young black scientists or engineers or technicians at the rate at which we want to, but definitely we are part of this country. Ntebaldi, I don't know if you want to respond to it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My comments will be as an industry, we, as Mr. Mwahi has said, we do try and comply to the Employment Equity Act requirements within the country. And I just wanted to outline some of the numbers that are in training right now. And as it was said, we're trying to improve on these numbers. For example, the SANA program right now has brought skills into the industry. There are about 51 people who have been absorbed by the industry. In just as an example, chemical engineering, metallurgical engineering. And of that 51, NNR has absorbed 4. PBMR 7, Nexa has absorbed 25 of those, and Eskom has absorbed 3. The MRCS has absorbed 1, Western House 1, and Itemba Labs 1. As you can see, this is an ongoing program, and hopefully, because this is a government-funded pipeline program for us, and we hope to improve on it. In terms of AREXA, AREXA focuses on in-service training, and to date, about 252 people have gone right through the industry, have gone through the AREXA training program, and it continues to grow, and as we identify critical needs areas for in-service members, we try and put them on the program. The next advisory program right now, we have about 13 undergrads, and we have about 23 postgrads. And then in terms of the DST NRF internship program, we currently have 20 interns through our working in our plant. And then our mentorship program right now, we piloted the program and using the Madalas as the mentors. For young people, we currently have 84 people who have gone through the mentorship program, and they have submitted portfolios of evidence of the work that they have done, especially the mentees. And it has been a successful program that we now are ready to replicate right through the organization. The Nuclear Skills Development Center currently has trained about 420 artisans, and most of them are what you call component artisans. These are highly skilled, for example, welders who can work on reactors and so forth. So it's a very, very, very good program that is becoming very, very successful. And in terms of our researchers, at the University of Pretoria, we have about 15 people working on our researchers in collaboration with them. Those are 15 postgraduate students. And at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, we have about 35 postgraduate people working within our researchers. And then in terms of the MAS program, within the MAS program is that some of our employees are supervisors and professors that offer courses at the University of the Northwest to this master's student. And currently, within the program, we have about 14 students. Thank you.
I think, just following on Dan's answer to Honorable Modao, I don't think we did quite answer him. And his real question was, what are you doing? Where are the big programs? you know, and it wasn't really about what training we're doing. And I think that we partly answered that with my reply about the finances, but in terms of the rest of the possibilities, obviously at Nexa, we are poised to go into big plans on nuclear fuel, should the go-ahead be given by Eskom. One of the frustrations one has in going to National Treasury at this point for preparatory funding is that one is told, well, there's no decision about the program. And so, well, why would we give you the money? But that, I mean, that's, in a sense, not how countries generally behave. You anticipate and you plan. You shouldn't be surprised by an announcement and then say, well, actually, you're not prepared. And so there's a bit of a disconnect there. With respect to other work by Nexa, you will have read that a number of us have been in the United States over the past 2 weeks. There was a summit convened by U.S. President Obama, to which our president attended, along with 46 other heads of state. There were a range of parallel industry meetings at that summit. There was a political summit, and then there was an industry summit as well. On the margins of that summit, Nexa and its subsidiary NTP have made a bid to supply the whole United States radioisotopes market. You can't announce an outcome before it's decided. That decision should be made sometime in June. But that, I think, is an area that we've been very successful in. And that success has actually bred success. And we're getting phone calls from other countries, and it's something which has grown exponentially over the last few years. And regardless of what happens in any Eskom program, we see that as an area that we will continue to grow in. But of course, it's not as big a project as a nuclear power program. So if you're talking about the big idea, well, that's it currently. And there are other ones which are in the pipeline, should there be decisions that are made with respect to the nuclear power program.
Thank you, Chair. Most of the issues have really been covered. I think just a few reflections, just also to indicate that in terms of the PBMR, what we have done as the regulator is to actually redeploy the individuals that were assigned to the PBMR program back into the organization in order for us to retain those skills. We have found suitable matches in terms of the skills that they possess and that which we require the regulator. And of course, the idea is that they will continue to perform functions in the newly designed organization. And if it should happen that the PBMR program resurfaces, we'll still have the benefit of those skills within the organization and be able to deploy them accordingly. That's just to give some comfort in terms of the retention and the redeployment of those skills. Just in terms of the old skills and the utilization thereof, I think it's a critical observation, Madam Chair. However, I think it is one that needs to be balanced against the issues of the broader strategy of growth and development in the country. I don't think that we can sustain our economy by using one same individuals and without diversifying and broadening access into the industry. Yes, they may still have some energy, they may still have certain expertise and skills, but it is that kind of expertise that must be shared broadly, okay, in the broader spectrum. And I think if we fail to initiate programs and initiatives that diversify the knowledge to as broad a spectrum as we possibly can get, to as diverse a profile as we possibly can get, then I think we'll be failing our nation. we do not want a situation where certain individuals will become indispensable because they possess certain expertise and skills to the detriment of the organization and organizational growth. And so in as much as we would retain and make use of those skills, the old skills, but it must be on a targeted basis. It must be on a basis where there is clear transfer of skills processes that are actually ingrained with certain performance deliverables that are attached to it. And so that's our approach to that issue. And of course, just to confirm that we also have had to file in employment equity reports, etc., just like any other organization in South Africa that is responsible should do so. We're not immune, Madam Chair, from EE processes. Thank you.
Okay. I'm not sure whether members still have questions, and I think Mr. Lucas put it very in a way that is a worrying factor for all of us. I think he represented us very well in terms of the PBMR and the technology thereof. Well, I'm sure you are not the only people who should give us some answers, but it's a broader discussion that we need to engage with public enterprise, I'm sure, if needs be, so that you can be in a better position. But it is a sad moment, I think, or a year, that we have to experience such whether you call it decommissioning or downsizing or whatever in your engineer language, Rob and others. End of the day, it means something that you're not continuing with. Human decommission, yeah. Whatever the appropriate language used, but it is a matter of concern if we still want to pursue the energy mix policy. That is the bigger picture. So I'm sure the department and the regulator and NEXA and PBMR will then we need to have much more discussions, I'm sure. Moving on. Any more questions? Happy? Not really happy, but somewhere in between. Okay. Thanks then the department and NEXA and NNR. Let's leave it there for now, and hoping that we'll still have to engage on this. Also, based on the discussions we had at the strategic plan workshop or meeting in Lagoon Beach, because the advocate also raised, and Mr. Moss raised a bit of issues that are of unintended consequences of some sort, but also just to comply with the concession others, our legislation needs to be amended a little bit. Né? So we'll come back to those, I think, as time also. But thank you very much, all of you. But continue doing the work. The problem that I thought members will also raise, there's so much that you do in the sector, but many of the people who should get the information don't get the information. Once you speak about nuclear, people think about bombs and, you know, just terrible things, bad things that are happening, rather than also the positive things that, okay. So the bigger question to all of you is, how then do you make sure that you can inform the South Africans, not only the academia and engineers and those who are whatever, ordinary people, just to get to know other means of energy, not only electricity, and what the nuclear is all about and all that. Next, sir, when is the resource center or whatever, the education center that should open in May?
You want to tell us about the opening of the
When you visited center. You hinted on that, yeah. And we're still coming for the second visit. But thanks for the first visit and the hospitality. And we're treated like VVIPs at NEXA, and we hope that we'll keep up that standard. and a challenge to some of the entities, but to set a very high standard for others. So we hope that they're not going to let us down when we visit them. They have to talk to NEXA and Petro SA what to do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Nuclear Science Centre is going to be handed over in May, and we are planning the opening to coincide with National Science Week. But yes, your invitations will be forthcoming for the opening.
Okay, we work with dates in Parliament and programs. So if we don't have the suggested date, it becomes a problem. You know that as you had. When you're opening that, we need to revise our program a little bit to the legislative process that is still not available to us. So the date will be very crucial. But we can work out the date, I'm sure. But unless we've got a proposed date.
Madam Chair, we have consulted with the Minister's office and we're waiting for an available date from her. And we'll send it in accordance with that.
But it's around May. Honorable Lucas, another lady may. That will be understood by those who were taking part in the 2010 prepared readiness. But be rest assured, energy-wise, we are okay in terms of the preparations and backup plans, whatever, any other means. I think we are ready for 2010. Don't feel any bad that the country will be in dark. It's positive report. Okay, can we then? You are free then to stay. NEXA and NNR department should be here though, I'm sure, because you are moving to the next item now. Update on the leak on the LPG. So that you can, if you want to stay, you can stay. But I'm sure you've been invited to the budget vote at 4:30, ne?
Yes.
Old Assembly Chamber, as well as the dinner after that in Stellenbosch. You'll be there. Sure. See you later then, or you can stay on. Oh yes, I've seen. Yes, no. You are then released, I think, to do that. I'm not sure from the department. I see Ukabazela Mkhize is here. Is he giving us an update?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Can you... I see the presentation here. There's no need to recapture.
Okay.
We still remember.
Yeah,
yes, sir. We still remember.
Yeah.
Okay. If you can just zoom into the update and the progress report, we'll be very happy.
Okay.
So that we can have some time then to have lunch and finalize our debate speech for the afternoon.
Okay. Going to be very quick, Madam Chair. I would also like to apologize for the DDG, Mr. Makubela, as well as acting DDG, Mr. Apane. They had to leave to join the minister at the press conference for 12 o'clock. I will quickly go to the update on the execution of the next steps. When it comes to the, which is a slide 8 there, where I look at the promulgation of regulations in respect of the maximum retail price of LPG for residential customers. We had aimed to have it done in March, end of March, for to come into effect in April. Unfortunately, in terms of the state law advisor, the opinion that we obtained there and had to incorporate was of such a nature that we had to relook at our approach, because we wanted to have the regulations promulgated and then to issue the price on a monthly basis. So the advice was that the minister is not empowered to promulgate the regulation on how to set the price, but empowered to set the price itself. And having thoroughly looked at that, we then had to to rework the regulations and take a big chunk of the regulations and put it under the working rules. With that in mind, then we ended up with a situation where we're saying that the we're going to get the also had to work on the LPG price for each zone, moving from coastal into inland in the same vein that we are doing for petrol and diesel. And it's been difficult to get the prices for the zones, for the respective zones, because LPG is not being moved exactly the same way as petrol and diesel. So we had to use the tankers that are used for LPG, and then consult with the Road Freight Association in that regard. Considering everything, we are optimistic that we'll be able to promulgate the LPG prices. I mean now the prices themselves by the 30th of April for to come into effect on the 5th of May with the rest of other fuels like petrol, diesel, and illuminating paraffin. The internal process approval process has commenced, which would then allow the promulgation by the minister. In terms of the review of the licensing regime, we said that these are other issues that we said we are going to do. The principal or primary issue that we are concerned with was the price itself, but there are these issues that we are looking at them that are also going to be enablers to assist in other respects as far as LPG pricing and security of supply are concerned. The first draft proposal has been done and is being considered internally as part of the approval process before we can engage with external stakeholders and also our sister department, so it's still at that stage. In terms of improving the supply, security of supply of LPG, in respect of also enabling import facilities, storage and distribution logistics to kick in. The update in that regard is that we have reconvened the LPG task team. The team has been formed and it has held one meeting. There's been some delays from the industry to give us the representatives so that we can go on with the engagements and get data on an ongoing basis in terms of the situation in terms of supply. And also that will also come to help us in terms of formulating a strategy that will deal with the supply logistics, not just looking at operations, but in the long term ensuring that there is supply. We have engaged also industry players and some prospective new entrants that are looking at venturing into the LPG industry and there be able to help us in terms of improving access or supply. The benchmark exercise looking at identified countries like Morocco and Botswana, we want to look at such countries, will commence next month in terms of building the strategy. The template has been drawn up for the operation site and we are awaiting population with data from some of the companies involved. And then on the maximum refinery gate price, because this gate price is we currently have the gate price, but it's pegged to the rated octane number of 93 lead replacement petrol. And what we're looking at now, we're still just doing some background work in terms of that. We'll commence in earnest with that in the second quarter of this year. Because we do have a gate price, all that we need to do is to revise or make some improvement in terms of that gate price. We've had, for example, to look at not having to use petrol as a proxy for the price, but to get direct prices because there are internationally, LPG is an internationally traded commodity, and we can get prices from institutions like Platts. We had during the visit to the UK, I also had a meeting with the guys from Platts, and we have looked at this possibility, and I think we can be able to move away from using a proxy to using direct prices, and thereby. We're hoping that this will also help because the price must consider the investment in import facilities, storage and distribution. terms of the pilot project updates, PetroSA has commenced its assessment of pilots. The pilots, because we said last time I was here, I reported that we'll be handing, we're looking at handing that over to PetroSA, failing which we will then have to maybe go through a tender process of issuing it to any interested party that will be able to fit in with our requirements as a department. The terms of reference for the post-pilot phase has been drafted, and now we are waiting for PetroSA to conclude its assessment. They've given us an indication that they will be able to complete the assessment next month and then be able to tell us if they're taking over those pilots and expanding them. The issues that we last time also talked about issues pertaining to empowerment, that is BEE and elimination of vertical integration. Those issues are also being dealt with separately as we relook at the empowerment regime that we currently are having in the sector. That's all from my side. Thank you.
Yeah. No, thank you, Mr. Mkize. Members, any questions, clarity, time for deliberations? From the previous update, this is another update. While they're still looking or not even, can you clarify this thing of what is it? On the promulgation of the price, Minister, is it slide 8? Minister empowered to set the price and not to promulgate regulation on how to set the price.
It's a technicality that the guys from the legal side have looked at it because when we're drafting with the our lawyer, our legal mind, we are of the view that the minister must say this is how this price is going to be set, these are the parameters, and then set the price, and then promulgate that as a regulation. And the issues of mathematics, the formulas, sit as working rules. Now, when the state law advisor, they came back and other legal people that we consulted, experts, they confirmed the advice that we got from the state law advisors, saying that the minister must just come and say, because if you look at the Petroleum Product Act, it says the minister would set the price. So the minister must just say the price for LPG is going to be this much, in the same vein that we are currently doing for petrol and diesel and paraffin, and not come up with a regulation and then come up with the price. The price itself is part of the regulation. So that's this technicality that we had to grapple with. We had to go to them to ask them to get clarity on this matter and see how we can go around it.
It's still very confusing to me because, as far as I understand, the minister has got powers to regulate as per the legislation and powers that are vested with her in terms of the legislative process. In a way, here you are saying it the way you are saying it, but still doesn't clarify me in terms of my main question. But to wait first, there are follow-ups from members. I've seen Lucas Mutau and Ross.
Yes, Madam Chair. I think pricing is very important. And what worries me if you're going to benchmark it on 953 unleaded fuel. Will that be correct? And then you must realize the biggest problem here, the LPG people in rural areas, because if you're zoning it, you zone it from your import, take KwaZulu-Natal, you say Durban, and as you go out, you start zoning it, and it gets more and more expensive, and it's more and more expensive to the rural areas, not the urban areas. And that's a very, it's a worrying point.
Actually, it was just a link up to that because I was happy to hear that you want to actually de-link it from the Octane 93 pricing so that it stands alone. Mm-hmm. If that would be the case, I'd probably be happy with that.
Hold on. Cover.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I remember when we started with the LPG, was that it's going to help the rural people from the high prices of electricity and the scarcity of electricity. But now when it comes like this, really, it is bringing a lot of uncertainty. You don't even know when we are among the villagers, what do you tell them? So I agree with what Honorable Lucas is saying, that for the rural people, because it's far, it's still going to be more than electricity. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Let me just respond to the issue of the benchmarking or the linking to 93 lead replacement petrol. The mandate from our side was to regulate the retail price of LPG. The price that I'm referring to of the last part portion of it, we are not touching it at the moment. It remains as is. But we said that we needed to then go back and review it. It's there set the maximum refinery gate price of LPG that is in there. One of the things that we are having, these are just considerations that we are having, is delinking that to petrol at a later stage. At the moment, we are doing this phase of looking from the refinery gate up to the end user. That being sparked by the outcry from the public in terms of the exorbitant prices. And we think that on a cost-by-cost basis, making a comparison, even if we're using this zonal pricing, at that particular zone, it will still work out cheaper than it has been. Because all you are saying is that you've got Durban, let's take Durban, for example, as an import, as a port of entry. It gets into Durban, then at Durban is priced at the maximum refinery gate price. You take it from there, you put the transport cost getting to, say, Newcastle. And then in Newcastle, what you do there is that you're using the tanker that transports LPG up to that level. You don't include the transportation of the cylinders. You only include the bulk LPG. So you are transporting the LPG itself instead of the steel. You get it there. When you are now at right in Newcastle, you then break the bulk. When you break the bulk, you put it into the individual cylinders. And from these cylinders, you're transporting it over a short distance to supply now the customers. So it's to be able to get that transportation is by a tanker, irrespective of whether it's a rural area or a city. So it shouldn't be the case. We do accept the fact that the price of electricity, as you know, with the tariffs going up, is going to be expensive, which is also going to make LPG a competitive alternative. And also, we do accept that generally there has been an increase in energy prices from the time this idea was being conceived up to now. But still, it's still going to work out cheaper than the current situation. This is our view.
That is the explanation from Kamal. So I'm not sure whether we do agree with him entirely. Partly agree with him, but partly not. And yeah, if there are no more questions, we'll hear that in May. Maybe May, what's happening, because we've been... we said we must get updates from time to time.
Yeah, yeah.
But today, he's a bit technical, a little bit. And Okabazan. But let's then wait for May. I'm sure as we restructure our program, we'll also include the LPG. as one of those ongoing, because we want to see the regulation operating this year, 2010, year of action. We don't compromise there. So you are doing well. Don't feel bad. It's just that there are those loopholes that are trying to close. But as the last question, why do you have to hear from Petro SA whether they're taking this on or not? Aren't you the department and they're an entity? Why? It's like you are begging them, I mean, to say, Petro SA, please take this project. You are a department. I mean, they're like your child. You don't beg your child. You give your child the instructions. What is the problem here with the department and Petro SA? Still waiting to hear from them in May, etc. and all that.
Madam Chair, I can say maybe this child is a bit past the adolescent stage. it's more like looking at them to say, instead of us as a department going on and doing all the assessment and saying to them, take this, we just said to them, do all the assessment from your side, look at the strategic fit, look at your capacity to be able to handle this, look at also at the socio-economic impact and the commerciality of what you want to do. And then we will discuss if you see some gaps so we can structure it accordingly. What we have done from our side is, in terms of the terms of reference, it is the terms of reference that we'll then say to them, in taking this project, know that there are these and these socio-economic imperatives. It's not just a commercial project, just alone. So it's part of harmonizing their mandate and this LPG project per se, because they are currently not involved in terms of downstream activities in the sense that you want to do it here. So it's just to be able to reconcile those two.
No, it's fine, but I think they can be like something that you can work on while you're still looking outside because of the budget in any way, that you can't afford to have an external person because that's money as well. To me, then they can be able to house that in the interim and in the long term, as you have the budget, then they can then go outside. Ne? Yeah, though a child is above the adolescent, he's still a child. My child, whether it's 50 years or 60 years, will remain my child.
Yeah,
they cannot say because now they are old, you disown them. They are still your children with some rights and whatever, but with responsibility. Okay, let's then, I think you want to have your last word? Yeah, we hope that you'll give us some progress report then in May and then be able then to move on with the LPG. But it's quite good progress, no?
Yeah.
From last year. Up to now, at least there's some work that we do as a department. Member Sam, I'm not sure. Is there any announcement? We'll see you at half past four, Old Assembly, and I'm sure you've received your invitations by now for the dinner after the budget vote. Ross?
Chairperson, can I just for the record say that we intend, and I received a letter last night. On my system from the people in Botaville, the Grain South Africa, that would like to engage with us in constructive talks regarding the renewable energy of ethanol, and I'm trying to arrange that we go to the Nampo farm, which is close to Botaville, but unfortunately the Nampo Usta is already the bookings have been made and it's and they would rather like to host us when there's more time so that we can have a constructive discussions regarding this, and I'd just like to have your permission, perhaps if I can proceed with arrangements and see, then I can make a full submission to this committee to be hosted at the Nampo Usta farm in Botaville regarding maize as a renewable energy source.
I think that's, we can
look into it.
Look at it at the management committee, I'm sure. Just write just few lines and then send to the management committee. But in essence, I think it's a good program. I hope it's not because you come from the Free State.
I come from that area, yes.
We are not a federalist. so it's just the good intentions.
Yes,
and
It's about the targets of renewable energy, the 30% by 2030.
Renewable energy. Okay. No, thanks. I think it is accepted, and then we'll get to the details in the management committee. I think we can then attend the meeting for today and wish you all the best in the debate.
Pardon? Just one question to my colleague here. How many women are involved in that? And what is the ratio of gender? No, you can answer that later.
Now. Okay. I was just saying a good luck for half past four today, and then I hope that you will enjoy the debate as well as the dinner. Then we'll see each other, I think, after the, what do you call it? Is it recess or constitution to the 10th of May, we'll then come back, either during the oversight.